You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of December 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Tonight they step off the plane as refugees, but they walk out of this terminal as permanent residents of Canada with social insurance numbers, health cards, and with an opportunity to become full Canadians.
Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau personally welcomes a plane load of refugees from Syria. What's stopping politicians south of the border from demonstrating the same hospitality? My guests Kathleen Burke and James Schneider will be discussing that and the day's other top stories, including an idea for a settlement for Syria drawn up by some of the politicians and militias who've been fighting Bashar al-Assad when they haven't been fighting each other. Are there any grounds for optimism? We'll look ahead to the second round of regional elections in France this weekend. Will the Front National hold their gains? And what will it mean if they do? And we'll take a look at the up-all-night cliffhanger that is local election day in Saudi Arabia, where, for the first time, they've decided to dip a tentative toe in the early 20th century and let women take part. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and James Schneider, Senior Correspondent at New African Magazine. Welcome both. We are going to start tonight by attempting optimism vis-a-vis the civil war in Syria, which is approaching the fifth anniversary of its beginning, and also the fifth anniversary of the last time anybody appeared to have any idea what to do about Syria. A meeting in Riyadh between Syrian opposition politicians and some of the less obviously deranged rebel groups has produced what they are pleased to describe as a statement of principles towards a peace process. Kathleen, first of all, these people say they want, and I quote, a pluralistic regime which represents all sectors. This strikes me as a possibly a new definition for easier said than done. How likely is any such thing from where we are now?
You notice they didn't say a sustained pluralistic.
That is true. That is true.
I should point this out. Bad marks for the essay. What can one say? If so, it will be, I agree with you, a new definition. It's also entirely unlikely because one of the more powerful ones is In-N-Out, Al-Aram. They say they want to do it by voting and so forth and not by power. And then they said we were going because they weren't allowing the militias to have the influence. It was all going to politicians, and then they came back in again. They can't quite sort it out in Riyadh. The idea of sorting it out in Damascus is really quite enjoyable.
They do also stress, James, that in their statement of principles, that they don't see any role for Bashar al-Assad or his aides in any sort of transitional government. Is there any reason at all why Assad would sign up for this then? He does actually kind of appear to be winning at the moment. His forces at least recaptured the last remaining rebel-held parts of Homs this week. We saw all those busloads of rebel fighters being taken elsewhere. Is there any reason why Assad should pay any attention to this?
Well, and the rebels have actually backtracked from their position even with this, because beforehand it was Assad has to go before any negotiations start. Now it's the principle of the negotiations has to be that he's not part of the transition. There's wiggle room for him in that as well, because you can have quite a long process before you have a transition. He's saying that he's there until there are elections. And as you say, the balance of forces have swung a bit his way. He has Russia keep missing ISIS when they're bombing and accidentally hitting rebel forces that are fighting against Assad. I'm sure it's a terrible accident and they're very upset with themselves about it. I'm not sure that he's going to be quaking in his boots that they're going to kick him, throw him off. But we should say that this is the fact that anybody within this hugely complex, lots of different people fighting different people side, at least that some of them are at least able to talk and come up with some kind of a common statement, even though it's miles away from anything that could actually get us further, that it doesn't have the Kurds in, that this main group that Kathy was talking about are actually in a different alliance with Al-Qaeda. There are some serious issues with it, but at least some people were able to sit down and talk for a while.
Well, exactly that point, Kathleen. They say they want a pluralistic regime, and they failed to invite the Syrian Kurds, among others, to these talks. Do we think they possibly have a fairly fixed idea of what pluralistic might mean?
Pluralistic are the ones that we can actually control or influence, you mean, and also ones perhaps that can fight even without being driven by guns in their back or whatever. Yes, I mean, the Kurds had their very own meeting, in fact, so they wouldn't be out entirely out of the party, I suppose. No, it's a mess. I think everyone in the world can agree it's a mess. The thing is that no one is going to come to an agreement unless they think they're going to get what they want. And Assad isn't going to come to an agreement till he's knocked out. ISIS isn't going to come to agreement until they dominate. The Kurds Kurds didn't get a chance to come to an agreement. I think they want their area where they are, and the rest can do whatever they want to do. So these sorts of negotiations, the problem is that the best negotiations, the best agreement is where everyone wins and everyone loses. And the problem is you've got negotiations here where it's seen as winner take all.
You mentioned Islamic State there, James. Is there, who obviously aren't part of these talks, and indeed it's very, very hard to imagine them ever being part of any talks, they don't seem like a reasonable bunch. Is there much in the way of point to any sort of negotiations before they have been dealt with? Because it is impossible to imagine that anything resembling a unified Syria can exist while Islamic State still control quite a lot of it.
Yeah, ISIS are not exactly the kind of people you can get round the table with and sort of meet them halfway. But, I mean, the counter-argument to what you just put forward is it's quite difficult to see how ISIS could be defeated without some kind of, relatively unified. I mean, you know, we're stretching the definition of unified here, but at least sides not actively fighting each other most of the time would do. And I think that probably is a necessary precondition for ISIS being driven out of its strongholds and being as degraded as it could be.
What do you think, in fact, about the possibilities of just partitioning the place into quartiles or whatever?
Well, I mean, these theories have been floated. I'm reminded a little bit of Bosnia 20 years ago, which various people suggested various things for dividing the country up or partitioning it or establishing cantons or such things. But this I mean, it seems to be like Bosnia to the power several. It is even more complicated than that. I mean, on that score, is it possibly fallacious to keep talking about Syria as if it's going to exist in the size and shape that it presently is?
It's only existed in the size and shape since about 1920. But then Czechoslovakia came and went during the same period. So one doesn't, and of course, Czechoslovakia became Czech Republic and Slovakia. I don't think it's an impossible thought that the British and French put those borders there. They're not borders that follow tribe, not borders that follow religion, not borders that follow much of anything. And so therefore, I don't think it's wholly impossible, no. But I think Assad won't be around if it happens.
I think the borders are quite likely to change in some significant way, but I don't think that the driving forces of this conflict are some desire to break up into different constituent units. I'm not sure that the parallel with Yugoslavia quite holds. I think that it would be very difficult to get many of the sides to respect the parcels of land that they're given because they don't view themselves as only being rightfully that, and it not being quite based in the same way on history, but is now more to do with contemporary politics and its and religion's politicization.
Well, we're going to stay with Syria, sort of, but to look at one of the global effects of the war. And this is that some 4.5 million or so people have left Syria since the war started. Some of them began new lives in Canada yesterday with a personal welcome from the Prime Minister. Justin Trudeau, who's promised that Canada will absorb 25,000 Syrians by February and another 10,000 by the end of 2016, was at Toronto International Airport to meet the first of the Royal Canadian Air Force flights bringing Syrian refugees who'd been living in Jordan and Lebanon. There is, of course, an obvious contrast with the current Trump-generated hysterics south of the border, although the contrast is probably not sadly sufficiently embarrassing to prompt a widespread rethink. Kathleen, why do the reactions and approaches of Canada and the United States seem so different, in that the United States, much more than Canada, likes to think of itself and advertise itself as a place to which people come, to, you know, your proverbial poor huddled masses.
It's been a long time since poor huddled masses were essentially welcomed in the United States, I fear. Part of Canada's drive, not just in this but almost anything, is to point out the, how different they are from the United States. So therefore, why, that's at least one very good reason for Trudeau to be, you know, wandering around saying, look how great we are, we're taking... This is not to say that the Canadians aren't being extremely good about it. I don't think we can object to that, as it were. But Canada is also huge territory without a lot of people. So there aren't a lot of vested interests to fight against having foreigners, as it were, in their territory. But Canada's a very nice country. And the fact that Trump and everyone else in America are behaving as they are, it makes it very easy and very desirable for Canada to say, look how wonderful you are, especially compared with the ridiculous hegemon in the South.
It is indeed the case that some districts and some cities in Canada have said that their demand for refugees is actually outstripping the supply of them.
Yes.
UNHCR have actually also said they've had trouble finding people in Jordan and Lebanon willing to relocate to Canada at such short notice. But James, is it just a question of that Canada can afford to take a loftier view of this than the United States because it has a smaller population, and it can afford to take a loftier view than Europe because it's so far removed from the crisis and therefore can control the numbers that come in?
I don't think there's a one-to-one correlation between landmass, population, and therefore view on migrants and on refugees. I think that Canada, as a country and under Trudeau, is also undergoing some sort of a rebranding after mm-hmm. 8 years of George Bush-inspired conservative rule. And I think that that's part of the prism through which this decision should be seen. This is a way of presenting themselves as being a nice nation again, in the same way, you know, when Trudeau put out his cabinet, which was majority female and very, very diverse, saying, "This is, you know, we have a cabinet that looks like Canada because it's 2015. This kind of feel-good stuff, which this does. I mean, 25,000 people, it's a very good amount by international standards. They're doing very well. But it is also a drop in the bucket in terms of a country of 40-plus million people and the 4.5 million people who are gone in Syria. So a lot of it is gestural and feel-good, which I think many Canadians will enjoy.
I mean, there is one thing that was interesting about this whole story is the fact that they're trying hard to find some refugees. I think one has to remember that Canada is a long way away from Syria and so forth. And a lot of migrants have been a lot of refugees have tried to say, look, we're not migrants. We want to go back to Syria when we can. And Canada is a long way away from the Middle East. So I think we have to also keep that in mind, that this may be the promised land in Canadian and American ideas, but it's possibly not quite so much for the best possible reasons in the eyes of some of the refugees.
There was a lovely story in one of the newspapers here today or yesterday where they found somebody at the world's northernmost mosque, which is somewhere right up in the sort of snowbound, further flung reaches of the Yukon. And the chap was pointing out that obviously during one of the problems, or an issue during Ramadan, which tends to fall when they get 20 hours of daylight, is that you can't possibly fast for that whole period. So you have to sort of, you know, try to do the whole thing by Mecca time or your hometown time instead. James, we should look at the different, to put it mildly, approach or discussion of the subject south of the border. Barack Obama has attempted to talk sensibly about the subject, as he generally does about most subjects, him being a sensible and reasonable fellow. Why don't many Americans seem to want to listen to him at the moment?
There is an enormous amount of fear and hysteria and Islamophobia in broad sections of the American public, which is whipped up and generated by a variety of things, which makes Obama, being however reasonable and serious and convincing he is to an audience that's listening to him, completely unable to convince an audience that isn't listening to him. And there's a pretty strong correlation between an audience of people that don't want to listen to a word that Barack Obama says, however well constructed, and those who who have this, you know, this kind of Trumpian, possibly proto-fascist. I mean, really, really sort of frightening and ignorant understanding of Islam, of Americans, of Muslims. I mean, of the world, yeah.
I mean, a final thought on this, Kathleen. Do we actually have to consider the fact that Donald Trump is apparently still prospering because he's spouting this trash rather than despite it?
Well, it has been argued by various commentators and poll takers that Trump has an irremediable basis, 25%, below which he will not go. But he also has probably an irremediable top of 35% above which he will not go. The fact that media follows the story, then obviously the story follows the big mouth. And the difficulty is as much with infotainment on television and journalism and so forth in the States as everything else. If no one paid any attention to him, if the media didn't give him the oxygen, would he still be so popular?
I think it is precisely because he says these things which are outrageous. I think we'll probably come to it more when we're talking about the Front National in France. But it's his anti-systemic appeal, I think, which means that in some ways, the more outrageous, the more condemned by the sort of liberal good thinking it is, the more appeal he gets to, as Kathleen said, this sizable minority, but it's still very much a minority.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Kathleen Burke and James Schneider. Coming up next, Saudi Arabia humours the world by holding elections, so we'll humour Saudi Arabia by discussing them.
Our ideas-packed Entrepreneur's Guide. The Design Directory for people who want to build a better home. The Style Guide for getting to grips with the business of looking good. The Soft Power Survey. The Travel Top 50. Monocle magazine has a superlative lineup of survey reports and investigations coming your way. And to make sure that you never miss an issue, you just need to do one thing: become a Monocle subscriber. Not only will you get all of this great journalism, you'll also have free access to our full archive of stories online, receive invites to subscriber events around the world, and be sent a free gift too. Go to monocle.com/subscribe to join us today.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and James Schneider. Now, all unregenerate tyrannies seem to feel obliged to pretend, whether to themselves or everybody else or both, that they are, in fact, democracies, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea being only the most extreme example of the syndrome. Saudi Arabia is deigning to hold elections for 284 local councils tomorrow, a largely futile charade only worth remarking upon for the fact that for the first time, and that date again, December 2015, women are being permitted to stand for office. Where will it all end? They'll be driving cars next. Kathleen, thin end of the wedge. Madness, obviously. I mean,
Well, it's the same thin end of the wedge that Britain had. You remember, it's only in the 1880s that women were allowed to run for office, and it was municipal office. And within a century, we had Margaret Thatcher. So, yes.
Something for Saudis to look forward to there, then.
Well, what can I say? They'll all wear robes, we won't know. The thing is that it is thin edge of the wedge. But what so many of those running have said, yes, but at least it shows it can be done. They're doing it for their daughters, they're doing it for their nieces, and one may actually be elected. These things are go in tiny incremental steps, and if the imams can accept this without slicing everyone up, there's a precedent set.
The women who are campaigning, it is worth noting, can only make their public speeches from behind partitions or by getting males to speak for them. I'm not making any of this up, which is a rider you always feel obliged to insert when discussing Saudi Arabia. James, do they deserve much of a round of applause for this?
I don't think they deserve a round of applause, but as was just said, it's these small steps that I then think lead up to a flood. I think then when you get enough of them, then you get this big shift. I don't think we should be applauding the Saudi regime for anything. It is I mean, if it weren't so barbaric and horrendous, it would be just ridiculous and funny. But it's absurd. So I think the people that we should be praising will be the unnamed, unfaced, unknown activists who have been pushing for this, who have been making probably incredibly difficult attempts at very small levels of social change, which will build up. And it's really them who should take it. And we shouldn't give any real credit to a regime that does quite awful things for a PR stunt.
Could I put in one small one hand clapping for King Abdullah, who actually went against his government. He'd said in 2005, women will get the vote soon. The government, the next one, said, oh, we don't, the technicalities aren't ready. Then it said next, they can't do it. And Abdullah himself said in 2011, the next election, women are going to be able to take part.
The benefits of absolute monarchy.
Well, okay. And he also, remember, he also appointed one-fifth of the Shura Council, which is as close as you get to a quasi-legislative parliament, one might say, in Saudi Arabia, thanks to him, has 20% women. All right. I'm not about to go dancing around the table either, but I have a strong feeling about in an country such as that, which has millions of years behind it and doesn't feel the pressure to change from outside, that is a not inconsiderable. That will be something they can't go back on.
Just to follow that up, Kathleen, and you're quite right, they feel or at least acknowledge no pressure from the outside. But is there enough of that? Does the world still tiptoe around Saudi Arabia untowardly?
Well, of course it does. Remember when The Guardian tried to tell voters in Ohio how to vote and they got hit back?
I mean, countries got George W. Bush reelected.
That's right. Well, let's think about that one. Countries don't like interference from other countries, and they certainly don't like other countries trying to put pressure on social things. I hold to my, speaking here as the one woman around the table, I hold to my idea that I think this can only be good, and it will continue to increase little by little, perhaps, but it's much better than going back little by little.
Countries do pressure other countries from outside all the times, of course, James. And just, it occurs to me, I mean, you know, obviously I understand why people tiptoe around Saudi Arabia, but it does occur to me fairly frequently that it is a regime certainly not dramatically better than South Africa circa the 1980s. And the entire world, in that case, pretty much just ganged up on them and said, we're ignoring you until you get with the program. Why is that impossible in this case?
Because of oil and the petrodollar circuit. Saudi Arabia, obviously a very huge oil producer, but not only is it a very huge oil producer, but it uses a tremendous amount of its returns from oil sales to buy US assets and treasury and keep the dollar in the position it is. So it's of, I mean, it's actually of geostrategic importance to extremely powerful the US, but also much, much broader about the global economic system, that they get appeased. That's not to say it's the right thing to do. It's absolutely the wrong thing to do. But it isn't just about corruption selling some arms deals. It's a much more structural, global, fundamental issue.
Okay, well, we're going to conclude tonight by looking at another sort of, I guess, local democratic difficulty. On Sunday, France will be voting in the second round of regional elections, a week after a first round in which polls were topped by Marine Le Pen's Front National, whose big selling point, of course, is that the party is no longer quite the quasi-fascist crackpot crusade founded by her completely ridiculous father. Kathleen, first of all, there is some suggestion that the FN result may look less impressive after the second round, that tactical voting may stop them from even winning a single region. But is there a lesson here that the more respectable, if you will, political parties of France should heed?
Yes, that their detachment from the voters seems to be a pretty strong one, I should have thought. If the socialists have a problem, all of France says they want change, and every time they propose change, you know, either party almost, all of France then revolts because any change means there are losers as well as winners. But it's hard to see France becoming the sort of country that the FN want. I think that the idea of the tactical voting on a large scale, the fact that the Socialist Party has pulled their candidates in any areas that where coming together with the other right-wing parties will actually keep out the Front National is a very good move. And it shows that perhaps it's energized the political elites in a way that nothing else would have done. And perhaps they will then take moves that seem too dangerous or not really necessary before.
The thing that strikes me about that, and I don't disagree with any of it, and I'll put this to you, James, is that when you talk about the other parties needing to learn lessons and reconnect with the voters and be more in touch with their concerns, when you boil away everything else, this is about immigration, isn't it?
I don't think it is just about immigration.
Really?
No, I think immigration is a big factor. I don't think it's just about immigration. I think the National Front is an anti-systemic force. It isn't just about immigration. What you have is a breakdown in trust in large sections of France's elite. Now, France's elite is even more all went to the same school, well, actually all the same finishing school, university, than Britain, if you can imagine it. And lots of the same people, you know, people who are classmates, run big companies and so forth, even more than Britain, if you can imagine it. And this elite feels very, very distant, and a lot of the Front National, what they're pulling into, it's not as if they've gone from having 15% of people who are terrified about immigration to now being 35% of people who are terrified about immigration. They're fishing in a water which is a rising tide of anti-systemic feeling. So I don't think the answer for the two main parties can just be, well, we have to message better, we have to be a bit more in touch with their concerns. I think they might actually need another anti-systemic force that can basically water down the Front National down to just the crackpots and the crazies that were more of the father's liking.
Kathleen, France's Prime Minister Manuel Valls made what struck me as a frankly bizarre outburst in which he suggested that the rise of the Front National could actually lead to civil war in France of some description. Is that a slightly hysterical prediction?
I think it's bonkers. I mean, let's just think about that. I mean, Haussmann took care of Paris, Baron Haussmann, back in the 1870s, of course. So, you know, knocking down all the areas where you could put up barricades easily, so that troops could march through. Who's the civil war going to be between? Is it going to be the socialists plus the Front National against the immigrants? Is it going to be the immigrants and the socialists against the Front National? We don't have a civil war. We have a mess. And who has the guns? Not enough. So, no, I think that's ridiculous.
James, it does strike me, though, that whatever the result this weekend, the Front National have demonstrated that they do have a following. They have a mandate of sorts. There are many, many similar parties rising all over Europe, especially this year for obvious reasons. Because of that, does it oblige more, if you will, reasonable and moderate parties to take a harder line on immigration in recognition of the fact that there are actual concerns, whatever the reasons for those concerns are?
No, because that hasn't worked. That is actually what has been happening in political parties right across the advanced industrialized world, or whatever you want to call it. Well, we'll just change our rhetoric. We'll move a bit harder. We'll close down some loopholes. We'll make it more difficult. That is precisely what they have done, and it has had no effect. In fact, this weight has grown. I think what we are seeing is a broader phenomenon, which is perhaps a post-financial crisis phenomenon. It's something where growing numbers of people do not trust the system in which they are in sufficiently to buy into it, which means that you get quite schizophrenic things going on. You get the rise of anti-systemic left parties, anti-systemic right parties, you get more conspiracy theories, you get more all sorts of things. So I think that political parties need to not just view it through the prism of, well, if we get tougher on immigration, this will all just go away, because actually it's a threat to the whole system in a much more fundamental way.
Final and very brief thought from you on this, Kathleen. Marine Le Pen, does she have to be regarded as a serious prospect for the presidency in 2017?
I think she does, in the sense that quite a few people think that she's going to be one of the two candidates. Will she win? I would be much more doubtful about that. But yes, I think she's a very strong possibility.
On that cheerful thought, we will leave it there. Kathleen Burke and James Schneider, thank you for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ilana Hanyukov. Our studio manager was Chad Childers. For the next half hour, Carlotta is sticking around with Monocle's international playlist. At 1900, Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. At 2200, it's The Daily with, I think I'm right in saying, Emma Nelson and Paul Osborne. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.